readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm thrilled you're taking time from your crazy holiday season to join me. So, how are you surviving? Yearning for some peace and quiet time? A moment or two to relax and enjoy a great read or listen? I've got just the thing with a cool little twist. At the recent Miami International Book Fair, I had the great joy of speaking with two wonderful writers, both of whom have made the prestigious New Yorker's 20 Under 40 list. You'll meet them during the show. They were amazing. So I decided to focus this edition of the Book Report on authors in the Under 40 category. We'll preview works from new writers, many of whom are on that list, and some you may already know. Not a moment to waste. Let's turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Jonathan Safran Foer's best-selling debut novel, Everything is Illuminated, wowed critics and took Book of the Year honors from the LA Times. In this heartfelt follow-up, extremely loud and incredibly close, the 34-year-old Foer continues to shine. 9-year-old Oscar Schell is a precocious Francophile who idolizes Stephen Hawking and plays the tambourine. He's also a boy struggling to come to terms with his father's death in the World Trade Center attacks. As he searches New York City for the lock that fits a mysterious key his father left behind, Oscar discovers much more than he could have imagined. Jeff Woodman, Barbara Caruso, and Richard Ferroni narrate.
I desperately wish I had my tambourine with me now, because even after everything, I'm still wearing heavy boots, and sometimes it helps to play a good beat. My most impressive song that I can play on my tambourine is The Flight of the Bumblebee by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, which is also the ringtone I downloaded for the cell phone I got after Dad died. It's pretty amazing that I can play The Flight of the Bumblebee, because you have to hit incredibly fast in parts, and that's extremely hard for me because I don't really have wrists yet. Ron offered to buy me a 5-piece drum set. Money can't buy me love, obviously, but I asked if it would have Zildjian cymbals. He said, whatever you want. And then he took my yo-yo off my desk and started to walk the dog with it. I know he just wanted to be friendly, but it made me incredibly angry. Yo-yo moi, I told him, grabbing it back. What I really wanted to tell him was, you're not my dad, and you never will be. Isn't it so weird how the number of dead people is increasing even though the Earth stays the same size, so that one day there isn't going to be room to bury anyone anymore? For my 9th birthday last year, Grandma gave me a subscription to National Geographic, which she calls THE National Geographic. She also gave me a white blazer because I only wear white clothes, and it's too big to wear, so it'll last me a long time. She also gave me Grandpa's camera, which I loved for 2 reasons. I asked why he didn't take it with him when he left her. She said, maybe he wanted you to have it. I said, but I was negative 30 years old. She said, still. Anyway, the fascinating thing was that I read in National Geographic that there are more people alive now than have died in all of human history. In other words, if everyone wanted to play Hamlet at once, they couldn't, because there aren't enough skulls. So what about skyscrapers for dead people that were built down. They could be underneath the skyscrapers for living people that are built up. You could bury people 100 floors down, and a whole dead world could be underneath the living one. Sometimes I think it would be weird if there were a skyscraper that moved up and down while its elevator stayed in place. So if you wanted to go to the 95th floor, you'd just press the 95 button, and the 95th floor would come to you. Also, that could be extremely useful, because if you're on the 95th floor and a plane hits below you, the building could take you to the ground and everyone could be safe, even if you left your birdseed shirt at home that day. I've only been in a limousine twice ever. The first time was terrible, even though the limousine was wonderful. I'm not allowed to watch TV at home, and I'm not allowed to watch TV in limousines either, but it was still neat that there was a TV there. I asked if we could go by school so Toothpaste and the Minch could see me in a limousine. Mom said that school wasn't on the way and we couldn't be late to the cemetery. "Why not?" I asked, which I actually thought was a good question, because if you think about it, why not? Even though I'm not anymore, I used to be an atheist, which means I didn't believe in things that couldn't be observed. I believed that once you're dead forever, and you don't feel anything, and you don't even dream. It's not that I believe in things that can't be observed now, because I don't. It's that I believe that things are extremely complicated. And anyway, it's not like we were actually burying him anyway. Even though I was trying hard for it not to, it was annoying me how Grandma kept touching me, so I climbed into the front seat and poked the driver's shoulder until he gave me some attention.
"What is your designation?" I asked in Stephen Hawking voice.
"Say what?"
"He wants to know your name," Grandma said from the back seat. He handed me his card. "Gerald Thompson, Sunshine Limousine, serving the five boroughs, 212-570-7249. I handed him my card and told him,
"Greetings, Gerald. I am Oscar."
He asked me why I was talking like that. I told him,
"Oscar's CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer. The more contact he has with humans, the more he learns."
Gerald said, "Oh." And then he said, "Kay."
That was Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. Karen Russell was raised in Miami, and that certainly shows up in her work. She's a 2006 graduate of Columbia University's MFA program. Her first book of short stories, St. Lucie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, was published in September 2006. In November 2009, she was named a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. In June 2010, she was named a New Yorker 20 Under 40 honoree. Her first novel, Swamplandia, is an eccentric yet revelatory family story and was published in February 2011, and we'll be talking with Karen about that. Swamplandia is told by Ava, one of the three sawtooth grandchildren who run the failing tourist attraction with the so-called Chief Big Tree, their father. Their mother, billed as Halola Big Tree, was the theme park's star attraction and the glue that held the family together. But Halola has died of cancer, and her absence is one of the novel's most vital and humanizing aspects. Swamplandia is in decline, and the family is disintegrating. Osceola, Ava's 16-year-old sister, has developed a romantic attachment to a ghost. The chief, their father, goes AWOL, and Kiwi, the girl's brother and the family realist, leaves to go to the World of Darkness, a competing theme park. Ava, a resourceful but terrified 13, is left to manage 98 gators and the vast, inscrutable landscape of her own grief. For all its magical realism and Florida Gothic, Swamplandia is a story of a family's effort to stay afloat in a world that is sinking. Welcome, Karen. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Hi, thanks for having me, Elaine.
Okay, I have to ask first off, I have a son named Seth. So why are the gators in this story named Seth?
I know. I think it's actually distracting that their name's Seth. One of my friends said she couldn't help but picture a lot of Seth Rogans just in a pit. But this particular family wanted tradition, and I think that Seth sounded like it had some Egyptian lore to it. You know, Set is the god of the dead. So I think that for these kinds of hucksters, like, it had the right sort of Disneyfied, you know, somber aura to call the alligator Seth.
Now, you currently live in New York, but you are a Miami native. The book is so lush in its descriptions of the areas. Did the Everglades call to you in your formative years?
They did. I thought that was the most mysterious place, you know, that we could possibly go in a Volvo, or you just drive for 40 minutes down the Dixie, and then you're in this total primordial world. But also, weirdly, it's like very close to the Miami subs, you know? So I really, something about that contrast, I thought was...
The pit barbecue.
The pit barbecue, right. Robert's Fruit Stand. Uh-huh.
You've had so many awards and kudos from top names in the literary area. Stephen King said, "This book will not leave my mind." When the honors started rolling in, how was that for you?
Oh, it was really dreamy, right? I mean, to the point that I just thought it was some global conspiracy. Like, I was like, maybe I'm dying, you know? I mean, it just felt that kind of surreal. And particularly Stephen King, I mean, that meant a lot to me because he was somebody who, during my formative reading years, I was just mainlining all of his novels. So, you know, to get to share company with that, this whatever's in Stephen King's mind, I thought was, like, was great.
You won the New Yorker's prestigious 20 Under 40 Award. So who are your favorite under 40 colleagues right now?
A couple people on that list. I was so excited to be on the list with them because Wells Tower is somebody whose work I really admire. Rivka Galchin is amazing. Chris Adrian. Now I'm sure to forget people. Stephen Merrill Block is a writer I admire a lot. I feel like Taya Obrett, of course, who everybody, you know, she blew up this year and it totally well deserved. She's a secret sorceress.
Oh. She'll be at the book fair, actually, tomorrow. How difficult was it to make the jump from short story to novel?
I think it was maybe the most challenging thing that I've had to do. It was a very different muscle to try to work, you know. I do think that sort of like the sprint to marathon analogy applies. So if you the energy required to sustain something for hundreds of pages, I think another good one is sort of like a one night stand to like a long term marriage, you know. It's a big commitment to take on.
Yeah. So. I imagine that the task of waking up every morning and filling up pages was daunting.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, you guys are still here, but it's been years. But it was also really rewarding. You know, with a short story, it takes so much energy to get the rules of the world pinned down, and then you sort of have to leave it, you know? So I loved living in that world over time, and I loved kind of watching the characters change on me over time. And I feel like I learned a lot, so.
Talk about that. I mean, I don't know if you work from an outline or what, but I've always wondered, your story is so lush. Did the characters really kind of write themselves in a way?
Oh my God, I'm always so jealous when people talk, you know, other authors will say that, oh, I just took dictation from this voice inside me and the character did things that surprised me. I didn't feel that kind of spirit level. There's a character in the book who's possessed by a ghost, and I would have honestly loved at certain points if like one of the characters would possess me and take the wheel. Definitely they changed in way, you know, the story took directions that I hadn't anticipated. The brother was just sort of a side character who ended up being really interesting to me, and he ends up having kind of his own story. Line. And I thought Ava's voice I could hear really clearly because there's a short story, Ava Russell's The Alligator, that the novel kind of flew out of or sprawled out of.
Now, Ava is really, she kind of tells the tale. Talk about writing a book from a child's perspective.
Yeah, I just sort of love, and a lot of the short stories I write end up being from adolescent perspectives, and I think it's just a fascinating time. I mean, I love writing about thresholds, so it sort of seemed to be a good story to set in a swamp, which is already this uncanny geography and really like a liminal space between land and water. You can't quite get your bearings, and I was like, that is what it felt like to me to be a teenager. Ava's this very kind of naive 13, and I thought for this story too, which has some sort of fantastical elements, it seemed really important. I mean, I don't think it would have worked if like Ava was like a 40-year-old woman who thought she could see ghosts. That story would read, you know, sort of like an asylum tale. It would be a very different effect. But I think what's interesting about kids is they have access to these fantasy worlds, fairy tale worlds, and they're also kind of coming alive to these new adult truths.
Yeah, I know. I know. I mean, her perspective on her sister and her sister's relationship with the ghost, etc.
Yeah, so there's sort of a double optic where I think she really is kind of toggling between worlds. Like, her brother is this hyper-rational, you know, Yale ambitious guy who's saying, our sister is sick. You know, she's really sick. She needs a doctor. She needs a psychiatrist. And then Ava herself is reading some of these same, you know, comic book, you know, haunted tales, fairy tales and myths. So it does seem sort of possible to her that her sister really might actually be talking to ghosts. And that kind of, to be on that, on the fence that way, you know, to kind of be able to access both explanations, like a rational explanation, a supernatural one. I think kids are kind of uniquely positioned to do that.
Swamplandia is so atmospheric. It almost seems made for the big screen. Have you had any conversations?
Oh, so HBO optioned the rights, which is really exciting. Scott Rudin has an agreement with them. So it would be, if it were to happen, I mean, you know, fingers crossed, but it's in development now. I would be over the moon. I really hope that it's for a series, actually, which is surprising. But they were talking about kind of like the comedy in the darkness and 6 feet under. Yeah. As sort of the attitude. It's so funny, people who grew up in Florida. I've just found this kind of traveling to promote the book, that on the West Coast, people be like, oh, it's imaginative. How did you come up with that stuff? And then here in Florida, everyone's like, we stepped over a gator to come to this reading, you know, or they're just tougher to impress. They're like, yes, yes, yes. Like, we just came from Gatorland. It's just like that, you know.
Yeah. Is it terrifying to have had so much success with your debut novel?
I guess if you consider the alternative, no.
Good answer.
I mean, I feel so totally lucky. I feel really relieved, actually, because there was a long period of time where, you know, the book, I sort of did it as a two-book deal, so I didn't even know if these characters would see the light of day. So mostly I just feel so grateful that the thing has, like, an ISBN number and exists outside of me, and, you know, I can have a Thanksgiving where my relatives aren't, like, full of pity and horror as I describe, you know, the book that I'm working on.
Yeah. Well, what are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on a new collection of short stories. So that's been really fun. And then after that, I'd really like to finish the second novel set during the Dust Bowl drought. So a big overcorrection for the swamp.
What do you want readers to take away from Swamplandia?
Oh, dear. I guess, like, the Cliff's Notes really boiled down answer is, for me, it's a story about, like, one family coming of age, you know, one family in this particular landscape coming of age and coming through grief and figuring out a new way to write the story. You know, I think everybody is sort of trying. The mother of the family has died. And so for me, it's really, and I think even the physical landscape Ava has to move through, which is, you know, monotonous sawgrass, this, like, grass with teeth, this really kind of swampy zone, into sort of a new understanding of herself and her family. So just sort of, how do you tell a new story in the wake of a catastrophe, or in the wake of grief? How do you become a more conscious storyteller of your own life?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for stopping by. I loved your book, and I have to tell you, since I have the copy, there's about 8 people on the list of, I want to read that next.
Oh, Elaine, thank you so much. This was a joy. This was so fun.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Swamplandia, narrated by Ariel Citrick and David Aykroyd.
Our mother swam blissfully on, brushing at the spotlight's perimeter as if she were testing the gate of a floating corral. Like black silk, the water bunched and wrinkled. Her arms rode hard. You could hear her breaststrokes ripping at the water, her gasps for air. Now and then, a pair of coal red eyes snagged at the white net of the spotlight as the chief rolled it over the pit. 3 long minutes passed, then 4, and at last she gasped mightily and grasped the ladder rails on the eastern side of the stage. We all exhaled with her. Our stage wasn't much, just a simple cypress board on 6-foot stilts, suspended over the gator pit. She climbed out of the lake. Her trembling arms folded over the dimple of her belly button. She spat water, gave a little wave. The crowd went crazy. When the light found her a second time, Halola Bigtree, the famous woman from the posters, the swamp centaur, was gone. Our mother was herself again, smiling, brown-skinned, muscular. A little thicker through the waist and hips than she appeared on those early posters, she liked to joke, since she'd had her 3 kids. Mom, Ossie and I would squeal, racing around the wire fence and over the wet cement that ringed the gator pit to get to her before the autograph seekers elbowed us out. You won! My family, the Bigtree tribe of the 10,000 islands, once lived on a 100-acre island off the coast of southwest Florida, on the Gulf side of the Great Swamp. For many years, Swamplandia was the number one gator-themed park and swamp cafe in the area. We leased an expensive billboard on the interstate, just south of Cape Coral. Come see Seth fang some sea serpent, an ancient lizard of death. We called all our alligators Seth. Tradition is as important, kids, Chief Big Tree liked to say, as promotional materials are expensive. The billboard featured a 10-foot alligator, one of the Seths, hissing soundlessly. Its jaws gaped to reveal the rosebud pink of a queen conch shell. Its scales are a wet-looking black. We Big Trees are kneeling around the primordial monster in reverse order of height. My father, the chief, my grandfather, Sawtooth, my mother, Halola, my older brother, Kiwi, my sister, Osceola, and finally, me. We're wearing Indian costumes on loan from our Big Tree gift shop. Buckskin vests, cloth headbands, great blue hair and feathers, great white hair and feathers, chubby beads hanging off our foreheads and our hair in braids, gator fang necklaces. Although there was not a drop of Seminole or Miccosukee blood in us, the chief always costumed us in tribal apparel for the photographs he took. He said we were our own Indians. Our mother had a toast brown complexion that a tourist could maybe squint and call Indian, and Kiwi, Grandpa Sawtooth, and I could hold our son. But my sister, Osceola, was born snowy, not a weak chamomile blonde, but pure frost, with eyes that vibrated somewhere between maroon and violet. Her face was like our mother's face, cast forward onto cloudy water. Before we posed for the picture on that billboard, our mother colored her in with drugstore blusher. The chief made sure she was covered by the shadow of a tree. Kiwi liked to joke that she looked like the doomed sibling you see in those Wild West daguerreotypes. The one who makes you think, oh God, take the picture quick, that kid is not long for this world. Our park housed 98 captive alligators in the gator pit. We also had a reptile walk, a 2-mile-long boardwalk through the Parotis Palms, and saw grass that my grandfather and father designed and built. There you could see caimans, gharials, Burmese, and African pythons, every variety of tree frog, a burrow hole of red-bellied turtles and lachrymose morning glories, and a rare Cuban crocodile, Methuselah, a croc that was such an expert mimic of a log that it had moved only once in my presence, when its white jaw fell open like a suitcase. We had one mammal, Judy Garland, a small, balding Florida brown bear who had been rescued as a cub by my grandparents back when bears still roamed the pine woods of the northern swamp. Judy Garland's fur looked like a scorched rug. My brother said she had ursine alopecia. She could do a trick, sort of. The chief had trained her to nod along to somewhere over the rainbow. Everybody, without exception, hated this trick. Her Oz nods terrified small children and shocked their parents. "Somebody help! This bear's having a seizure!" the park guests would cry. The bear had bad rhythm. But we had to keep her, said the chief. The bear was family.
That was Swamplandia by Karen Russell. Winner of a Commonwealth Writers' Prize and the Orange Prize for Fiction, 34-year-old Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie continues the literary tradition of Chinua Achebe, her country's great author and poet. The Thing Around Your Neck is her brilliant collection of stories focusing on life's many clashes, tradition with modernity, African culture with American life. Ajua Ando narrates this series of haunting, character-driven tales.
My father asked Nmabia to write a report, how he had sold the jewelry, what he had spent the money on, with whom he had spent it. I didn't think Nmabia would tell the truth, and I don't think my father thought he would either, but he liked reports, my professor father. He liked things written down and nicely documented. Besides, Nmabia was 17, with a carefully tended beard. He was in that space between secondary school and university and was too old for caning. What else could my father have done? After Nmabia wrote the report, my father filed it in the steel drawer in his study where he kept our school papers.
That he could hurt his mother like this, was the last thing my father said, in a mutter.
But Nmabia really hadn't set out to hurt her. He did it because my mother's jewelry was the only thing of any value in the house, a lifetime's collection of solid gold pieces. He did it, too, because other sons of professors were doing it. This was the season of thefts on our serene Nsoka campus. Boys who had grown up watching Sesame Street, reading Enid Blyton, eating cornflakes for breakfast, attending the university staff primary school in smartly polished brown sandals, were now cutting through the mosquito netting of their neighbors' windows, sliding out glass louvers, and climbing in to steal TVs and VCRs. We knew the thieves. And Soka campus was such a small place, the houses sitting side by side on tree-lined streets, separated only by low hedges, that we could not but know who was stealing. Still, when their professor parents saw one another at the staff club, or at church, or at a faculty meeting, they continued to moan about riff-raff from town coming onto their sacred campus to steal. The thieving boys were the popular ones. They drove their parents' cars in the evening, their seats pushed back, and their arms stretched out to reach the steering wheel. Osita, the neighbor who had stolen our TV only weeks before the Namabia incident, was lithe and handsome, in a brooding sort of way, and walked with the grace of a cat. His shirts were always sharply ironed. I used to look across the hedge and see him, and close my eyes, and imagine that he was walking toward me, coming to claim me as his. He never noticed me. When he stole from us, my parents did not go over to Professor Ebube's house to ask him to ask his son to bring back our things. They said publicly that it was riffraff from town, but they knew it was Osita. Osita was 2 years older than Mabia. Most of the thieving boys were a little older than Namabia, and perhaps that was why Namabia did not steal from another person's house. Perhaps he did not feel old enough, qualified enough, for anything bigger than my mother's jewelry. Namabia looked just like my mother, with that honey-fair complexion, large eyes, and a generous mouth that curved perfectly. When my mother took us to the market, traders would call out, "Hey, madam! Why did you waste your fair skin on a boy and leave the girl so dark? What is a boy doing with all this beauty?" And my mother would chuckle, as though she took a mischievous and joyful responsibility for Namabia's good looks. When at 11, Namabia broke the window of his classroom with a stone, my mother gave him the money to replace it and did not tell my father. When he lost some library books in class 2, she told his form mistress that our houseboy had stolen them. When in class 3 he left early every day to attend catechism, and it turned out he never once went and so could not receive Holy Communion, she told the other parents that he had malaria on the examination day. When he took the key of my father's car and pressed it into a piece of soap that my father found before Namabia could take it to a locksmith, she made vague sounds about how he was just experimenting, and it didn't mean a thing. When he stole the exam questions from the study and sold them to my father's students, she shouted at him, but then told my father that Namabia was 16 after all and really should be given more pocket money.
That was The Thing Around Your Neck by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. The Sisters Brothers by 36-year-old Patrick DeWitt was shortlisted for this year's Man Booker Prize. To hear a sampling of that title, go to bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of July 2nd. Today we're previewing DeWitt's Ablutions, which the author narrates. A barman works in a famous but declining Hollywood bar. Morbidly amused by the decadent decay of his surroundings, he watches the patrons fall into their nightly oblivion, making notes for his novel. In the hope of uncovering their secrets and motives, he establishes tentative friendships with the regulars. But as his tenure at the bar continues, barman begins to serve himself more than his customers. The moments he lives outside the bar become more and more painful. He loses his wife, his way, and finally himself. Trapped by his habits and his loneliness, he realizes he won't survive if he doesn't break free.
Discuss the regulars. They sit in a line like ugly, huddled birds, eyes wet with alcohol. They whisper into their cups and seem to be gloating about something. You will never know what. Some have jobs, children, spouses, cars, and mortgages, while others live with their parents or in transient motels and are on government assistance, a curious balance of classes particular to the parts of Hollywood devoid of Klieg lights and make-believe. There are sometimes limousines at the curb out front. Other nights feature police cars and ambulances and vicious street scenarios. The bar interior resembles a sunken luxury liner of the early 1900s, mahogany and brass, black burgundy leather coated in dust and ash. It is impossible to know how many times the ownership has changed hands. The regulars are warm with one another, but generally come and go alone, and as far as you can tell, have never been to one another's homes. This makes you lonely, and the hearts of the world seem cold and stingy, and you are reminded of the saying, "Every man for himself," which as a child made you want to lie down and be killed. You do not take much stock in the North American definition of the word, but you suppose these people are alcoholics. They like you, or anyway are used to you, and they reach out to touch you when you pass as though you are a good luck gambling charm. You once found this repulsive and would circle the bar with your back hugging the wall rather than move through the network of fleshy red hands, but you have reconciled yourself to the attention and it has become familiar, even enjoyable for you. It now feels more like a commendation than an intrusion, recognition of your difficult job, and you nod and smile as the hands grab you around the waist, rubbing and slapping your back and belly. From your post at the sidebar entrance, you watch them watch themselves in the mirror behind the bar, preening, pecking, satisfied by their reflections. What do they see in their murky silhouettes? You wonder keenly about their lives prior to their residence here. Strange as it seems, they must have been regulars at some other Hollywood bar, but had moved on or been asked to move on, and they sought out a new retreat, settling down with the first free beer or kind word, some bartender's impotent joke mutilated beyond recognition in its endless retelling, and the regulars turn to tell the joke once more. You wonder also about their present lives, but to make inquiries is purposeless. The regulars are all sensational liars. But you want to know what it is about their existence that fuels the need to inhabit not just the same building every night, but the same bar stool, upon which they sip the same drink. And if a bartender forgets a regular's usual, the regular is cut down and his eyes swell with a lost suffering. Why? It bothers you to know that the truth will never reveal itself spontaneously, and you keep on your toes for clues. When you first come to work at the bar, you drink Claymore, the least expensive, or what is called the well scotch. This was your brand when you were out in the world, and you are happy to finally find a never-ending complimentary supply. You have been at the bar for 2 years, drinking Claymore in great quantity, sometimes straight, oftentimes with ginger ale or cola, before the manager, Simon, asks why you don't drink the quality liquors.
That was Ablutions by Patrick DeWitt. The Vagrants by 39-year-old Yi Yun Lee is set in China in 1979. During the Cultural Revolution, countless unspeakable acts occurred in towns and cities throughout China, and here in the industrial town of Muddy River, lovers betrayed lovers, children denounced their parents, and neighbors became sworn enemies. A few years later, the townspeople of Muddy River convene at a public stadium to witness an execution. 28-year-old Gu Shan was a Red Guard leader in her youth. She is now sentenced to die for her counter-revolutionary writings and unrepentant attitude. Lee's stunning debut novel follows those affected by the execution, her parents, her neighbors, and a handful of Muddy River's social outcasts. The book demonstrates how corruption and cruelty, fear and moral ambiguity reflect the dehumanization of an entire society. Jackie Chung narrates.
He had no intention of arguing with her, nor had he answers to her questions. He quietly dressed and moved to the front room, leaving the bedroom door ajar. The front room, which served as kitchen and dining room, as well as their daughter Shan's bedroom before her arrest, was half the size of the bedroom and cluttered with decades of accumulations. A few jars, once used annually to make Shan's favorite pickles, sat empty and dusty on top of one another in a corner. Next to the jars was a cardboard box in which Teacher Goo and Mrs. Goo kept their two hens, as much for companionship as for the few eggs they laid. Upon hearing Teacher Goo's steps, the hens stirred, but he ignored them. He put on his old sheepskin coat, and before leaving the house, he tore a sheet bearing the date of the previous day off the calendar, a habit he had maintained for decades. Even in the unlit room, the date, March 21st, 1979, and the small characters underneath, Spring Equinox, stood out. He tore the second sheet off too and squeezed the two thin squares of paper into a ball. He himself was breaking a ritual now, but there was no point in pretending that this was a day like any other. Teacher Goo walked to the public outhouse at the end of the alley. On normal days, his wife would trail behind him. They were a couple of habit, their morning routine unchanged for the past 10 years. The alarm went off at 6 o'clock, and they would get up at once. When they returned from the outhouse, they would take turns washing at the sink, she pumping the water out for both of them, neither speaking. A few steps away from the house, Teacher Goo spotted a white sheet with a huge red check marked across it, pasted on the wall of the row houses, and he knew that it carried the message of his daughter's death. Apart from the lone street lamp at the far end of the alley and a few dim morning stars, it was dark. Teacher Goo walked closer and saw that the characters in the announcement were written in the ancient Lee-styled calligraphy, each stroke carrying extra weight, as if the writer had been used to such a task, spelling out someone's imminent death with unhurried elegance. Teacher Goo imagined the name belonging to a stranger, whose sin was not of the mind, but a physical one. He could then, out of the habit of an intellectual, ignore the grimness of the crime. A rape, a murder, a robbery, or any misdeed against innocent souls, and appreciate the calligraphy for its aesthetic merit. But the name was none other than the one he had chosen for his daughter, Goo Shan. Teacher Goo had long ago ceased to understand the person bearing that name. He and his wife had been timid, law-abiding citizens all their lives. Since the age of 14, Sean had been wild with passions he couldn't grasp. First a fanatic believer in Chairman Mao and his cultural revolution, and later an adamant non-believer and a harsh critic of her generation's revolutionary zeal. In ancient tales, she could have been one of those divine creatures who borrow their mother's wombs to enter the mortal world and make a name for themselves as a heroine or a devil, depending on the intention of the heavenly powers. Teacher Goo and his wife could have been her parents for as long as she needed them to nurture her. But even in those old tales, the parents, bereft when their children left them for some destined calling, ended up heartbroken, flesh and blood humans as they were, unable to envision a life larger than their own.
That was The Vagrants by Yoon Lee. With the unnamed, 37-year-old Joshua Ferris imagines the collision between one man's free will and the forces of nature. Tim Farnsworth walks. He walks out of meetings and out of bed. He walks in sweltering heat and numbing cold. He will walk without stopping until he falls asleep, wherever that is. This curious affliction has baffled medical experts and comes close to ruining what should be a happy life. Tim has a loving family, a successful law career, and a beautiful suburban home, all of which he maintains until his feet start moving again. What drives a man to stay in a marriage, in a job? What forces him away? Is love or conscience enough to overcome the darker, stronger urges of the natural world? The Unnamed, narrated by the author, is a deeply felt novel of modern life, ancient yearnings, and the power of human understanding.
He reached the stairs and put his hand on the oak newel and took one step after another.
family photographs made the ascent with him. The sound of the grandfather clock ticking away in the living room gave way to the television laughter issuing softly from the bedroom down the hall. Jane was still beautiful. She was wearing a pair of reading glasses that had a pop art zaniness of character, teardrop frames polka-dotted with drops of primary color. Spaghetti straps revealed her slender arms, and the nightgown held her firm breasts in place, just below a freckled slate and an articulated clavicle. She was doing the crossword. Whenever she got stuck, she glanced up at the late show on the flat screen mounted to the wall and drummed the pen between upper and lower teeth, as if to waken her brain. She looked at him as he entered, surprised to see him home so early. "Hello, Banana," she said. He took off his suit coat as if it were a T-shirt, thrusting the back over his head and turning his sleeves inside out. Then he found himself grabbing the hem, a hand on each half of the parted tail, and ripping the thing in two. Hard to break the seam at first, but once the first thread snapped, it went. Jane opened her mouth, but nothing came out. He dropped the tattered coat and climbed onto the bed and hunkered down on his hands and knees like a man waiting for an explosion. "What is it?" she said. "Tim, what is it?" His head was lost inside his sheltering arms. "Tim?" She moved over to him and put her arms around him, hugging him from above as if they were about to engage in a wrestling match. "Tim." He told her that he had been forced out of the building and into the street. At 43rd and Broadway, he hailed a cab, which he hoped would take him back to the office. After getting the cab to pull over, he reached out and opened the back door, but then he walked on. The driver, a Sikh in a pink turban, honked the horn, staring at him through the rearview mirror. Why would someone hail a cab and open the door only to keep walking? Near Union Square, he had tried to call an ambulance, a recourse they had envisioned during his last recurrence. He was on the line with a dispatcher trying to explain the situation when he slipped on a patch of ice coming off the curb and lost his grip. "My phone!" he cried out as he regained his balance. "Somebody, my phone!" He walked on with a tweaked back. "Please get my phone!" His BlackBerry had landed in the middle of the street where it lay defenseless against oncoming cars. He kept moving forward. He told her of all the city's scaffolding he walked under, the manic traffic he managed to avoid, the parade of oblivious people he passed. He told her that he turned tired in the old way by the time he reached a bench somewhere near the East River where his body gave out.
That was The Unnamed by Joshua Ferris. With her debut novel, The Tiger's Wife, Taya Obrecht became the youngest writer on the New Yorker's 20 Under 40 list and was named to the 2010 National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 list. Taya was born in 1985 in the former Yugoslavia. She spent her childhood in Cyprus and Egypt. Her family settled in the States in 1997, and she attended the University of Southern California, receiving her MFA from Cornell. Welcome, Taya. Thank you so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are truly one of the stars of the literary world right now. How do you handle all the adulation?
I think that it's, you know, just I feel overwhelmingly grateful. I know plenty of writers who write for years and then have one breakthrough book, or who struggle with getting a readership, and I just feel so very, very fortunate that all this is happening to me. It's a gamble.
How does it affect you when you sit down to write your next work?
I think that the biggest consequence has sort of been time. I've been on tour pretty much since March, with a few stops in the, you know, in between, and I'll be on tour through April still. So I haven't really had time to sit down and get entrenched in a novel the way I really need to be. But I think that it's important in a way, because it's helping me to get disconnected from The Tiger's Wife. I don't want every sentence in the next one to sound like a sentence from the last one. So I think that time is the only way to do that.
I wondered why a tiger and not a lion, who is king of the jungle, but why a tiger?
You know, the book was inspired because of a National Geographic episode that I saw on TV, and it actually started with an image of a tiger in the snow. That was sort of the triggering moment for me. I thought there was something just incredible about that, about, this sounds so silly, but the contrast of a tiger standing in a snowy forest. I mean, and Siberian tigers do live in snow, which is sort of a strange evolutionary, you know, mix up, it's clearly not camouflage. So something about that image was very powerful for me, and it stuck.
Yeah. Animals play a very important role in this book. How important are they to you?
They're very important. I grew up going to zoos, which sounds sort of weird and sad, but I think that I have a childlike fascination with animals, and I'm a total nature show nerd. And I will still, you know, if I'm in a new city for long enough, I will still go to a zoo. So the way they work in the book and in my other work is to reroute the character. They sort of get dropped in as these out of place, roadblocks, and they reroute the character's reactions and decisions. And I don't know quite why that is, but I'm trying to develop some theories.
Kind of like the elephant that makes his way in the nighttime that the grandfather takes the main character to see.
Exactly, yeah. It's sort of a... the character's life is going along at a certain pace with certain preoccupations, and then something outside of it comes in and is jolting. And that outside influence, usually in my work, is some kind of animal. Why is that? I don't...
All right, let's talk about The Jungle Book, which was so key to this story. How did you come to choose that as such the prized possession of the grandfather?
You know, it's funny how that happens. I grew up with The Jungle Book, and with the second Jungle Book as well, with The Jungle Book set. And it was one of the first books that I read in Serbo-Croatian, and then one of the first books that I read in English. So I have a very deep childhood connection to it. Its role in the novel really was meant to just be a way for the grandfather to understand what a tiger is physically, you know, the animal, the entity, what is a tiger. And then as the novel progressed and all these layers sort of started to work together, I realized that the book itself had to have much more importance than that the book became a talisman of the grandfather's life. And that was one of those unexpected surprises of writing a novel. You don't realize how much of it is going to run away with itself.
I have to ask, which book was more vivid, the Serbo-Croatian one or the one in English? What did you were more entranced by when you were reading it?
Oh my goodness. Maybe a good way to answer this is when somebody says The Jungle Book to me, the associated image that I have is of the Serbian cover, which was this white hardcover, very small, very glossy book with a tiger on the front, sort of the tiger's head coming out of jungle bracken. So probably the Serbian one.
Hmm. In the book, of course, it's such a strong relationship between the main character and her grandfather. Is that similar in your life? Are you that close with your grandparents?
I am, and I was certainly very, very close with my grandfather, and it was a huge shock to me when he died. And, you know, that was the emotional trigger for the book. I wouldn't have written it without that event, which is sort of a strange thing to think about. It's like something that I'm living with now every day as a huge positive in my life is derived from a great tragedy. So I'm trying to figure out how I feel about that. I guess that's the best possible outcome of tragedy. But I'm very close to my grandparents. They raised me. They lived with us until I was 12. So I still go back to Serbia to visit my grandmother once a year. And the relationship between Natalia and her grandfather ended up being very heavily based on my relationship with mine, which was another one of those surprises. I was like, I'm not writing about my grandfather. This is just some grandfather. And then finished it and went back and was like, oh. So, yeah.
There are two worlds in the book, present day, the real world, and the more mystical, folkloric world. How did you meld the two? How did you accomplish that feat in your novel?
I think that understanding when I went back to the Balkans in 2010, and I was going back every year, but certainly not in a research capacity. I had always previously, you know, I had understood that there was a conflict between those two worlds in Balkan life in general. But and the book was already written and it was already being edited. And then I went back in 2010 to research vampires for a nonfiction piece for Harper's. And ended up realizing, because we were asking people these incredibly uncomfortable questions about their lore and about their regional history and about how they felt about having that kind of association with their own past and how they lived with it, I realized that often the world of myth and the world of fable becomes very much a reality of history that people live with in the Balkans. So I think that really reinforced that and helped me to understand how to navigate it, you know, how to negotiate it in the book. Yeah.
In your research for the vampires, I mean, were people telling you actual interactions they had witnessed with vampires?
Yes, they were. people had, you know, people that we visited lived in villages that that have a very strong presence in vampire history, like Kisiljevo or Zarozhye, and those are places that, you know, when you read, you know, The History of the Vampire by, you know, Vampire von Vampire or whatever.
I read that.
It's good, isn't it? Christmas reading. No, when you read those tomes, you know, you see these village names, and when we went to look for these places, we knew that they or something derivative of them would exist, and they didn't really show up on maps proper. You sort of had to find the village next to it, find the village on the other side of it, and then drive between them to come to the place. But people living there, you know, very much lived with their history. We met a man who had seen a vampire in his young adulthood, and he was like pushing 93, and his whole, you know, he lived in a house with his whole family, generations and generations of it, and they had all been told this story. But when he came to tell us the story, everybody lined up to hear it again. And it made me, you know, it made me wonder, like, how is the story going to be told after his passing? And like, how is it going to be handed down as family legend? And eventually it becomes, I'm sure, the way you really see a person, the way you really see somebody's history. And that was very much the theme of those, you know, those vampire stories had mutated in very strange ways. And people really do live with it and believe it. And sometimes they deny believing it, but they take precautionary measures anyway, you know. So.
Okay, maybe that's not on my top must-travel-to list. Back to the melding of the two worlds, have there been authors that you've read that have been your inspiration for blending the present day with the magical realism?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and have been since I was, you know, a teenager. And sort of my relationship to his writing and my fandom of his writing, if you will, has changed over the years because in reading something like Love in the Time of Cholera, which, you know, when I first read it, I was like, this is a beautiful, the most romantic book I've ever read. I will love this forever and ever. I will eat roses, you know, like that kind of attitude towards it. And then as time went on, realized more and more the darker aspects of it, things about it that he's actually really saying about love, the comparisons of love and disease. And then, you know, as a more mature reader went, wait a minute, this is not, this is not, you know, the sort of revel, veneration of love that I thought it was. But then it made the book, you know, that much more incredible to me. Writers like my absolute favorite book of all time at this moment is Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita. And I think it's just incredible. And, you know, the devil comes to Moscow and wreaks havoc. And all of it is accepted as total reality, even though he's writing it, you know, he's writing it to satirize Stalinist Russia. But he's writing it as reality. And it's not considered magical realism, but it really should be. It's you know, just because it's Eastern European canon.
Let's talk about Eastern European writers. I think most American readers aren't very familiar. Who would you suggest to sort of have people get their feet wet?
Bulgakov.
Say that name again slowly.
It's Mikhail Bulgakov, or Mikhail Bulgakov. Sorry, that was a mispronunciation. I also really love Ivo Andrić, who is, you know, the Yugoslav, I'll say Yugoslav now, noblest and just incredible writer. He wrote The Bridge on the Drina and several, I'm trying to think of it in translation, The Damned Yard and other stories. and you know, just wonderful, wonderful writing. And he was a historian, and he also had a real feel for that relationship between history and the present, and history and myth, and how they all combine.
Now, the Deathless Man, he is not a vampire, but talk about how you began to create him.
He's sort of, you know, I encountered him as a reader first in several folk tales, that are, you know, they're Balkan and then Russian and German, and there's this sort of melting pot of folk tale-y influence. He was usually this village idiot who had somehow tricked or trapped or disappointed death. In folk tales of that particular region, death is usually, you know, walking, talking character. It's not this ethereal concept. It's very much, oh, there he is, you know. He's punished by either immortality or immediate death. Considering what I was going through in my life, I became fascinated with the question of in what possible scenario is immortality, or actually the absence of death, a punishment. I couldn't understand it. So, you know, he appeared in a couple of early short stories that didn't quite work out, and then made his way into the novel, where he became not as sinister as I thought he was going to be, but very comforting and sort of goofy. And he changed as a character, and it became pleasant to be around him in the writing, which was also a surprise.
Well, after your exhaustive book tour, are you already writing the next book?
I am in my mind. sorry. I've started the next one. Had a few sort of hiccups along the way, a few false starts. But I think that I've finally latched onto something that I really do care about. My biggest preoccupation was having the same feeling towards the project that I did about The Tiger's Wife, which was, I must write this no matter what happens. You know, I you know, clearly there's something going on in the act of writing this that is a necessary process for me. And I think that without that feeling, the next one will just be dead as a project, as a you know, work of mine. I just want to get that back, and now I think that I have it. Thank God.
Well, we'll be waiting for it. Talk just a little bit about how difficult it was for you to get The Tiger's Wife published from the very beginning.
It was actually it was a wonderful process from the very beginning, and I my agent signed me on an incomplete manuscript on like 70 pages, and that was a beautiful thing. I mean, that happens very rarely, and I felt very, very fortunate, and sort of a big shot of confidence, because, or shot of hope, because he believed in it enough. And then when I finished it, there was an auction between several houses, and a young editor at the Dial Press at the time, Noah Eaker, won it, and acquired it. And he and I began to work together, and it was a long road because it was a long road to publication, because there was the issue of, oh, okay, well, we'll push it back a couple of months on the publication schedule. And then I was like, but wait, now that you've done that and I've gone vampire hunting, I will write hundreds of more pages for you. So that was sort of the most frustrating process of it, both for him, I'm sure, and for me, but made the book better. And so I felt very lucky to be working with people who really believed in it and really cared about what happened to it. And that was a big, big deal for me.
Well, it's an amazing, entrancing, bewitching book. And thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
For a sample of The Tiger's Wife, go to bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of May 21st. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this look at an amazing group of young writers. I know I've been really entertained by many of the works previewed today. Perhaps you've heard a work you'd like to pick up for yourself, or a last-minute gift inspiration for folks on your list. And speaking of inspiration, I know we're down to the wire here for shopping. Make sure to check out bookreportradio.com as your resource for the titles anyone would like to receive. Thanks so much for joining me today. Good luck with your final holiday preps, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.